or your weapons. I know it's obsessive and unhealthy. It's also practical as hell. I mentally rehearse what I'd do if an intruder broke in the garage door. Grab knife from block, rush forward to block him in the door, stab, stab, stab. While he's reeling, slice the tendons at the ankles, down. Always, in my rehearsals, it's Mel coming for us. Mel, looking exactly the same as he had in the trial, wearing a charcoal gray suit his lawyer had bought, with a blue silk tie and pocket square that matched his denim-colored eyes. He looks like a well-dressed, normal man, and the disguise is perfect. I hadn't been in the crowd at his court appearance, where everyone reported he'd looked like a perfectly innocent man. I'd been locked up, awaiting my own trial. But a photographer had captured him at just the right moment as he turned and looked at the crowd, the victims' families. He still looked the same, but his eyes had gone flat and soulless, and seeing that picture had given me the eerie feeling that something cold and alien was inside of that body, staring out. That creature hadn't felt the need to hide anymore. When I imagine Mel coming for us, that's what's staring out of his face. Exercise done, I make sure all the doors are locked. Connor has his own code, and when he comes home, I'll listen for the tones and the reset. I can tell if it's wrong, or if he forgets. The key fob to set the whole system to alert and ring in the Norton Police Department is constantly with me in my pocket. My first action in any emergency. I sit down at the computer in the bedroom I've made my office. It's a smallish room, with a narrow closet that holds winter clothes and supplies, and it's dominated by a battered, magnificent roll-top desk I rescued from an antique shop my first day in Norton. The date penciled on the drawer puts it at 1902. It's heavier than my car, and someone has used it as a workbench at some point, but it's so large that it comfortably holds computer, keyboard, and mouse, plus a small printer. I enter my passcode and hit the target to start the search algorithm running. This is a relatively new computer, bought fresh when I got to Stillhouse Lake, but it's been customized with all manner of black hat goodies by a hacker who goes by the name Absalom. In the days and weeks and months after Mel's trial, while I sat in jail and endured my own legal torment, Absalom had been one of a huge baying pack of online abusers to go after me, analyzing every aspect of my life for hints of guilt. After I was acquitted, though, the firestorm really started. He'd unearthed every detail of my life and made it available online. He'd organized troll armies to relentlessly attack me, my friends, my neighbors. He'd found even my most distant relatives and doxed their addresses. He'd hounded the two cousins that Mel still had living and driven one of them to the brink of suicide. But he'd drawn the line when the trolls he pushed in my direction went after my kids instead. I'd gotten a remarkable message from him just after that hideous campaign started, a heartfelt email that talked about his own childhood traumas, his own pain, and how he'd pursued me to banish his own demons. The train he'd started couldn't be stopped. The crusade had taken on a life of its own, but he wanted to help me, and what was more, he could help me. By that time, we'd been on the run out of Wichita, desperate and uncertain, and having him offer a hand? That had been the turning point. That had been the moment I'd retaken control of my life, with Absalom's help. Absalom isn't my friend. We don't chat, and I suspect he still hates me on some level. But he helps. He builds false identities. He finds me safe havens. He does what he can to control the constant online harassment. When I get a new computer, he images it from backups he keeps in a secure cloud so I don't lose data. He writes the custom search algorithms that allow me to keep track of the sicko patrol. For his favor, of course, I pay him money. No need to be pals. We keep it strictly business. While the search is running, I make a cup of hot tea with honey and sip it with my eyes shut, gathering myself for the challenge. I always keep certain things within reach as I do this. A loaded gun. My cell phone. ready to speed dial Absalom if there's an issue, and last but not least, a plastic garbage bag into which I can throw up, if necessary. Because this is hard. It's like sticking my head into a blast furnace, a writhing fury of mindless hatred and vile fury, and I am always shaken and scorched when I back away. But it has to be done, daily. I feel the tension spiral down from my head, slithering like a cold serpent along my spine, my shoulders, and coiling heavily in my stomach. I'm never fully prepared when the search results come back, but today, as ever, I try to be calm, observant, distanced. There are 14 pages of results. The top link is new. Someone's opened a thread on Reddit, and now the gruesome descriptions, speculations, and howls for justice are ginning up again. I grit my teeth and click the link. Where's Melvin's little helper these days? Would love to pay that church lady hypocrite bitch a visit. They like to call me church lady because our family had been a member of one of the larger Baptist churches in Wichita, though Mel was spotty on attendance. I'd usually been there with the kids. There are plenty of ironic pictures posted on that theme, split screens of me and the kids at church, crime scene photos of the dead woman in the garage. On Sunday mornings, Mel had usually excused himself by saying he had things to do in the workshop. Things to do. I have to close my eyes for a moment because there's a hidden monster's joke in those words. He'd never thought of the women he'd tortured and murdered as people. He thought of them as objects, things. I open my eyes, take a breath, and move on to the next link. Hope Gina and her kids get raped and ripped and hung up like meat so people can spit on them. Mutilating Mel don't deserve a family. That one's accompanied by a crime scene photo of someone else's kids shot and dumped in a ditch. The callous hypocrisy is breathtaking. This troll is exploiting someone else's personal horror to make his point about mine. He doesn't care about children. He cares about revenge. I run through the rest in a sickening rush. You see his daughter, Lily? I'd bump that till it's cold. Burn them alive and put 'em out with piss. I got an idea. Find some working outhouse and drown the kids in shit, then send her directions on where to find them. How can we make her suffer? Suggestions? Anybody got eyes on the bitch? On and on and on. I leave Reddit, go to Twitter, find more threats, more hate, more vitriol. Just in concise 140-character bites. Then the blogs. 8chan. The true crime message boards. The websites that are shrines to Mel's crimes. On the message boards and websites, the deaths of innocent young women are casual drive-by entertainment, historical information. At least those armchair detectives aren't very threatening. Mel's family is just a footnote to the real story for them. They're not dedicated to our destruction. The ones who are more interested in us, in Melvin Royal's missing family, those are the ones who could be dangerous. And there are hundreds, maybe thousands of them, all competing to outdo one another with terrible new ways to punish me and the kids. My kids. It's a sick horror show, devoid of even a shred of conscience. None of them recognize that they're talking about people, real people who can be hurt, who bleed, who can be murdered. Or if they do recognize that, they absolutely don't give a shit. There are some, an unnerving skim of this unholy broth, who are true, cold sociopaths. I print it all out, highlight usernames and handles, and begin cross-referencing in the database I keep. Most of the names on the list are old hands at this. They have, for whatever reasons, fixated on us. Some are newer, zealous acolytes who've just stumbled on Mel's crimes and are looking to exact some retribution for the victims. But it's really got nothing at all to do with Mel's victims. I rarely see any of their names mentioned. To this particular crop of vigilantes, the victims didn't matter alive, and they don't matter now. It's an excuse to let their vilest impulses out to play. These trolls are no different from Mel in many ways, except that unlike him, they probably won't act on those impulses. Probably. But then, that's why I keep the gun sitting next to me, to remind me that if they do, if they dare come near my kids, they'll pay the price. I will not let anyone hurt them ever again. I pause in reading because whoever the psychopath is behind the handle, Fuck Mall to Hell, he's stumbled over a careless piece of court paperwork that has one of our older addresses. He's publicly posted the street address, looped in victims' families, called reporters, sent out downloadable posters that have our pictures on them with the words, Missing, have you seen these people? It's a tactic these savages have adopted recently, trying to play on genuine humanity and concern. He's preying on the better instincts of people to rat us out so that predators can reach us more easily. I'm worried for the innocent people now living at that address he's distributed, though. They might not have any idea what's coming. I send an anonymous email to the detective in the area, a grudging ally, to let him know the address is being passed around again, and I hope for the best. Hope that the family living in that house doesn't wake up to packages of rancid meat and dead animals nailed to their door, to a flood of torture porn, to terrifying threats in their inboxes and mailboxes and on their phones and at their work. I clearly remember the shock of discovering the flood of abuse being leveled at my empty house, even though I was safely in jail and the kids had been spirited away to Maine. If the current residents have kids, I pray they aren't targeted. Mine were. Signs on telephone poles, their pictures sent to pornographers as models. There are no limits for the hate. It's free-floating, a toxic cloud of moral outrage and mob mentality, and it doesn't care who it hurts, only that it does. The address that this particular troll has uncovered is a dead end. It can't lead him to our door, or our new names. There are at least 8 broken trails between where he points and where I now sit. But that doesn't comfort me. I've gotten good at this out of sheer necessity. But I'm not them. I don't have the same rancid drive. All I want to do is survive and keep my kids as safe as I can. I finish checking, shake the stress out of my arms and hands, drink the cold tea, and stand up to pace the office. I want to hold on to the gun as I do, but that's a terrible idea. Unsafe and paranoid. I stare at the quiet gleam of it, the safety it promises, though I know that's a lie, too, as much a lie as any Mel ever told me. Guns don't keep anyone safe. They only equal the playing field. Mom? A voice from the doorway, and I turn too quickly, heart hammering, glad that I don't have the gun now because surprising me is a bad idea, and it's Connor standing there, book bag dragging at his right hand. He doesn't seem to notice that he's startled me, or he's so used to it, he doesn't care. Is Lanny okay? He asks me, and I force a smile and nod. Yes, sweetie, she's fine. How was school? I am only half listening because I am thinking that I didn't hear him come in, didn't hear the code, didn't hear the reset. I'd been too deep in concentration. Dangerous. I should be more aware. He doesn't answer the question anyway. He gestures at the computer. Did you finish the sicko patrol? It catches me by surprise. I say, where did you hear that? But I answer my own question. Lanny? He shrugs. You're looking for stalkers, right? Right. Everybody gets mean stuff on the internet, Mom. You shouldn't take it so seriously. Just ignore them. They'll go away. That, I think, is a maddening thing to say on so many levels, as if the internet is a fantasy world inhabited by imaginary people, as if we're ordinary people in the first place, and most of all, it's such a young male thing to say, this automatic assumption of safety. Women, even girls of Lanny's age, don't think that way. Parents don't. Older people don't. It reveals a certain blind, entitled ignorance to how dangerous the world really is. It occurs to me, a little sickly, that I've helped him form that attitude because of how I've insulated him, protected him. But what else can I do? Constantly terrify him? That can't help. Thanks for the opinion I didn't ask for, I tell him. But I'm all right with doing this. I sort the papers and file them. I've always kept both electronic and paper records. In my experience, the police are more comfortable with paper. It feels like proof to them in a way that data on a screen doesn't. In an emergency, we might not be able to pull data in time anyway. Sicko patrol completed, I say, then shut and lock the file drawer. I drop the key in my pocket. It's attached to the alarm fob, and it's never out of my possession. I don't want Connor or Lanny to go through those files. Not ever. Lanny has a laptop of her own now, but I have strict parental controls enabled. Not only does it not give her the results, but I'll be alerted, and have been, when she tries to search keywords about her father, the murders, or anything related to it. I can't risk giving Connor a computer quite yet, but the pressure to give him online access is growing at an impressive rate. Lanny flips her door open and flits past the office, dodging Connor on her way down the hall. She's still wearing her goth pants and Ramon's t-shirt, black hair fluttering in the breeze. Heading to the kitchen, I guess, for her typical afternoon snack of rice cakes and energy drink. Connor stares after her. He doesn't look surprised, just resigned. All the sisters in the world and mine has to dress like somebody out of The Nightmare Before Christmas, he says. She's trying to make herself not as pretty, you know. It's a surprising insight from a kid his age. I blink, and it strikes me hard that beneath her oversized pants and shaggy hair and corpse makeup, Lanny is pretty. Growing into her bones, turning tall and hinting at curves. As a mom, I always think of her as beautiful. But now others will, too. The edgy style keeps people at a distance and changes the standards by which she will be judged. That's clever and heartbreaking at the same time. Connor turns and heads off to his room. Wait, Connor, did you reset the alarm? Of course, he calls back without stopping. His door closes with finality, but no force. Lanny returns with her rice cakes and energy drink and flops into the small chair in the corner of my office. She puts the energy drink down and gives me a mock salute. All present and correct, Master Sergeant, she says. Then she slumps at an angle functionally impossible for anyone over 25. I've been thinking. I want to get a job. No. I can help with the money. No. Your job is to be in school. I have to bite my lip to keep from complaining that my daughter used to like school. Lily Royal had liked school. She'd been in drama class and a programming club. But Lanny couldn't stand out. Couldn't have interests that made her special. Couldn't make friends and tell them anything approaching the truth. No surprise it made school hell for her. This girl you got into the fight with, I say. You understand it can't happen. Why you can't get into these things?
I didn't get into it. She started it. What, you want me to lose? Get the shit beat out of me? I thought you were all about self-defense.
I want you to walk away.
Oh, sure, you would. That's all you do, walk away. Oh, I'm sorry. I mean, run.
There's nothing quite as scorching as a teenager's contempt. It has a breathless sting, and it lingers for a very long time. I try not to let her see she's scored points, but I don't trust myself to speak. I pick up the teacup and head for the kitchen, the comfort of running water to rinse away the dregs. She follows, but not to hit at me again. I can tell by the way she's hanging back that she regrets having said it and isn't quite sure how to take it back, or even if she wants to. As I put the teacup and saucer in the dishwasher, she says, "I was thinking of going out for a run." Not alone, you don't, I say, which is automatic, and then I realize she was counting on it. A non-apology apology. I hate even giving up the control of letting them ride the school bus, but venturing out on their own around the lake? No. We'll go together. I'll change. I change into leggings and a loose t-shirt over a sports bra, heavy socks, good running shoes. When I come out, Lanny is stretching lithely. She has on a red sports bra, no shirt, and black leggings with harlequin patterns down the sides. I just look at her until she sighs, grabs a t-shirt, and pulls it on.
Nobody else runs in t-shirts, she grumbles at me. I say, I'm going to want that Ramones shirt back. It's a classic, and I'll bet you can't name a single song. I want to be sedated, Lanny immediately shoots back. I don't respond. Lily had been medicated a lot that first half year after the event. She hadn't been able to sleep for days, and when she finally had fallen into a restless doze, she'd woken up screaming, crying for her mother, the mother who was in prison. Unless you'd prefer We're a Happy Family. I say nothing, because her song choices are completely on point. I turn off the alarm, open the door, and call for Connor to reset it. He grunts from somewhere down the hall, and I have to hope he means yes. Lanny rabbits ahead, but I catch up at the end of the gravel drive, and we head east on the road at a good, loose lope. It's a perfect time of day, with the air warm, the sun low and friendly, the lake calm and dotted with boats. Other joggers pass us heading the other direction, and I open up the pace, Lanny pulling easily up. Neighbors wave at us from porches. So friendly. I wave back. But it's all surface, this trust. I know if these good people knew who I really was, knew whom I'd married, they'd be just like our old neighbors. Distrustful, disgusted, afraid to be anywhere near us. And maybe they'd be right to be afraid. Melvin Royal casts a long, dark shadow. We're halfway around the lake before Lanny, gasping, calls a halt to lean against a swaying pine. I'm not winded yet, but my calf muscles are burning, and the points of my hips ache, and I stretch and keep up a light, in-place jog while my daughter catches her breath. You okay? I ask. Lanny gives me a filthy look. That's a yes? Sure, Lanny says. Whatever. Why do we have to make this so Olympic level? You know why. Lanny looks away.
Same reason you signed me up with that Krav Maga freak last year. I thought you liked Krav Maga.
She shrugs, still studying some fronds down by her shoes. I don't like thinking I need it. Neither do I, baby. But we have to face facts. There are dangers out there, and we need to be ready. You're old enough to get that. Lanny straightens up. Okay, guess I'm ready. Try not to run me lame this time, Terminator Mom. That's hard for me. While I was still Gina, but after the event, I'd taken up running, and it had been grueling and exhausting until I built up my strength. Now, when I stop holding myself back, I run like I feel breath on my neck, as if I'm running for my life. It's not healthy or safe, and I'm well aware that driving myself that hard is a form of self-punishment, and also an expression of the fear I live with every day. I forget, despite my best efforts. I'm not even aware of Lanny falling back, gasping, limping, until I'm around a curve and realize that I'm running alone in the shadow of the pines, not even sure where I lost her. I end up stretching against a tree and, finally, perching on a handy old boulder as I wait. I see her in the distance, walking slowly, limping a bit, and I feel a surge of guilt. What kind of a mother am I? Running a kid into the ground like that. That sixth sense I've developed suddenly drenches me in adrenaline, and I straighten up and turn my head. Someone's there. I catch sight of a person standing in the shadows of the pines, and my nerves, never calm, go tight. I slide off the boulder and into a ready stance, and I face the shadow head on. Who is it? He gives me a dry, nervous laugh and shuffles out. It's an old man, skin like dark, dry paper, gray whiskers, gray curls tight against his scalp. Even his ears droop. He leans heavily on a cane.
Sorry, miss. Wasn't mean to worry you. I was just looking at the boats. Always liked the lines of them. Never was much of a sailor, though. I spent my time on dry land.
He wears an old jacket with military patches on it. Artillery patches. Not World War II, but Korea, Vietnam. One of those less clear-cut conflicts.
I'm Ezekiel Claremont. Live right over there up the hill. Been here since half ever. Everybody this side of the lake calls me Easy.
I'm ashamed for assuming the worst, and I advance and offer my hand. He has a firm, dry grip, but his bones feel fragile beneath it. Hi, Easy. I'm Gwen. We live up over there, near the Johansons.
Oh, yeah. You're some new folks. Nice to meet you. Sorry I haven't been up that way, but I don't do as much walking these days. Still healing up since I broke my hip 6 months back. Don't get old, young lady. It's a pain in the ass.
He turns as Lanny lurches to a stop a few feet away and braces herself, bent over with her hands on her thighs.
Hello. You okay there?
Fine, Lanny gasps. Peachy, hi.
I don't quite laugh. This is my daughter, Atlanta. Everybody calls her Lanny. Lanny, this is Mr. Claremont. Easy, for short.
Atlanta. I was born in Atlanta. Fine city, full of life and culture. Miss it sometimes.
Mr. Claremont nods decisively to Lanny, who returns the gesture after a guarded look at me.
Well, I'd better get myself on home. Takes me a while to get up that hill. My daughter keeps after me to sell my place and move somewhere easier to get around, but I'm not ready to give up this view just yet. You know what I mean?
I do. You going to be okay? I ask, because I can see his house, and it's an impressive distance uphill for a man with a bad hip and a cane.
Fine, fine, thank you. I'm old, not decrepit. Not yet. Besides, the doctor says it's good for me.
He laughs.
What's good for you never feels good, in my experience.
Boy, is that true, Lanny agrees. Nice to meet you, Mr. Claremont.
Easy, he says, starting his way up the hill. You run safe now.
We will, I say, then turn a sweaty grin on my daughter. Race you the rest of the way.
Come on, I'm practically dead here.
Lanny.
I'll walk, thanks. You run if you want.
I was kidding.
Oh.
2. We've almost made it home again when my phone pings with a text message. It's an anonymous number, and hackles immediately go stiff at the back of my neck. I come to a stop and step off the road. Lanny gleefully jogs on by. I swipe and open. It's from Absalom. It has his cryptic little text signature as the first character. A. Then, are you anywhere near Missoula? He never asks exactly where we are, and I never tell. I type back. Why? Somebody's posted a thing. Looks like they got it wrong. I'll try to head off and divert. Bad for whoever they're tagging. CYA. That was Absalom's standard sign-off, and sure enough, no more pings arrive. I assume he uses disposable phones, just as I do. His number changes every month like clockwork, always unrecognizable, though his symbol usage is totally consistent. I can't afford that many burners, so mine stays the same for 6 months at a time. The kids' phones for a year. A little stability in an unstable world. The second that someone gets close, though, I burn everything. Phones, email accounts, everything. If there's a second close call around our location, Absalom notifies me, and we pack up and go. That's been our routine for the past few years now. It sucks, but we're used to it. We have to be used to it. I realize I'm looking forward to receiving that treasured conceal carry permit in the mail with an almost physical hunger. I'm not one of those jackasses who feel the need to strap an AR-15 to their back to pick up groceries. Those people live in a dystopian fantasy where they're the heroes in a world full of threats. I understand them, in a way. They feel powerless in a world full of uncertainty. But it's still a fantasy. I live in the real world, where I know that the only thing that stands between me and a thriving, violent, organized bunch of angry men could be the sidearm I carry. I don't need or want to advertise that fact. I don't want to use it. But I'm ready and willing. I'm fully committed to our survival. Lanny's celebrating wildly up ahead, and I let her have her victory. We stop at the mailbox for the day's haul of mostly junk mail. Lanny's stopped limping by now. Charlie Horse smoothed away. But she continues to pace as I sort through the envelopes. I'm just a couple in when I realize that someone's walking toward us down the road, and I feel my body shift into a balanced stance, a different state of alertness. It's the man from the gun range, the one who's de-escalated Carl Goetz from murder to general mayhem. Sam. I'm surprised to see him here, on foot. Have I ever glimpsed him around here before? Maybe at a distance. He looks vaguely familiar in this context. I must have seen him out walking or jogging, like so many others. He continues walking in our direction, hands in his pockets, headphones in. When he sees me watching him, he gives me a vague wave and nods and keeps walking right past us, heading the opposite of the route we took around the lake. I keep my attention fixed on him until he goes over the slight rise that branches off to the upper homes, the Johansons, a little above ours, then Officer Graham's place, and he disappears. Just taking a walk. But where is he coming from? It's probably obsessive that I feel I need to know. As we enter the house, I turn to enter the alarm code. My fingers touch the keypad before I realize that I don't need to enter the code, because the alarm isn't beeping. It isn't on. I freeze, standing in the doorway, blocking my daughter's way in. She tries to push past, and I give her a fierce, wild look and put my finger to my lips, then point to the keypad. Her face, pink from the exercise and sun, goes tense, and she steps back, and back again. I keep an extra set of car keys in the potted plant just inside the door, and now I scoop them out and toss them to her as I mouth, "Go." She doesn't hesitate. I've trained her well. She turns and runs for the Jeep, and I shut and lock the front door behind me. Whatever's inside, I want to keep it focused on me. I put the mail on the closest flat surface, careful not to make much noise, and the house lays itself out for me, all my options running fast through my mind. It's only four steps to the small gun safe under the couch. I kneel down and press my thumb to the lock, and the door springs open with a small metallic click. I pull out the Sig Sauer. It's my favorite and most reliable weapon. I know it's loaded and ready, one in the chamber, and I keep my pulse slow and my finger off the trigger as I move quietly across to the kitchen, the hallway, down. I hear the Jeep start up and pull away with a hiss of tires on gravel. Good girl. She knows to keep driving for 5 minutes, and, if I don't give her the all clear, to call the police, then head for our rendezvous point almost 50 miles away, and dig up a geocached stash of money and fresh IDs. If she has to, she can disappear without us. I swallow hard, because now I am alone, with the fear that something terrible has happened to my son. I'm drawing close to my bedroom. When I steal a look inside, I see nothing out of order. It's just as I left it, down to the shoes tumbled carelessly in the corner. Lanny's bedroom is next on the same side, across from the main bathroom that we share. For an awful moment, I think someone's ransacked her room, but then I realize that I never checked it before heading out to the range this morning, and she'd left the bed unmade, discarded clothes slumped over half the floor. Connor. The pulse in my temples throbs faster, and all my self-control can't slow it down. Please, God, no, don't take my baby, don't. His door is shut. He's put up a keep-out zombie inside sign, but when I carefully, slowly, try the handle, I realize that it isn't locked. I have two choices, either fast or slow. I enter fast. Banging the door open, gun coming up in a smooth arc as I brace myself with a shoulder against the rebounding wood, and I scare my son half to death with the whole production. He's lying on his bed, headphones on and music audible from where I stand, but the percussive bang of the door against the wall brings him bolt upright, clawing the headphones off. He yells when he sees the gun, and I instantly lower it, but not before I see blind terror in his eyes. It's gone in a second, replaced by boiling fury.
Jesus, Mom, what the hell?
I'm sorry, I say. My pulse is hammering perversely much faster now, responding to the adrenaline dumped into my bloodstream by the shock. My hands are shaking. I put the weapon down carefully on his dresser, ejection port up, barrel pointed away from both of us. Range rules.
Honey, I'm sorry. I thought... I don't want to say it out loud. I managed to drag in a trembling breath and sink down to a crouch, hands pressed to my forehead. Oh, God. You just forgot to turn it on when we left. I hear the music shut off in mid-scream. The headphones clatter to the floor. The bed creaks as Connor sits on the edge of it, looking at me. I risk a glance at him, finally. My eyes feel red and hot, though I'm not crying. I haven't in a long time.
The alarm? I forgot to turn it on?
He sighs and bends forward, as if he has a sore stomach.
Mom, you've got to stop going off the rails. You're going to kill one of us, you know that? We're out here in the middle of nowhere. Nobody else even locks their doors.
I don't answer. He's right, of course. I have overreacted, and not for the first time. I have pointed a loaded gun at my child. His anger is understandable, and so is his defensiveness. But he hasn't seen the pictures I get when I go through the Sicko Patrol postings. It's a hobby of a particular subset of online stalkers. Some of them are very good at Photoshop. They take gruesome crime scene photos and graft our faces onto victims. They alter images on child pornography, so I see my daughter and son brutalized in unimaginable ways. The one that haunts me, and I know will always haunt me, is the image of a young boy Connor's age, mutilated and left lying in a tangle of blood-soaked sheets in his own bed. That one popped up recently with a caption, "God's justice for murderers." It's right that Connor's angry at me. It's fine that he feels unfairly blamed and hemmed in by stupid, unnecessary, paranoid rules. I can't help that. I must defend him from very real monsters. But I can't explain that to him. I don't want to have to show him that world, the reality that runs like a black river underneath this one. I want him to stay in the world where a boy can collect comics and put fantasy posters on his walls and dress up like a zombie for Halloween. I say nothing. I stand up, when my legs are capable, and pick up the gun. I walk out and shut the door quietly behind me. Through it, my son yells, "Wait until I tell social services." I think he's joking. I hope. I walk to the gun safe, put the SIG back in, and lock it away before I call my daughter and tell her to come home. I reset the alarm as I do. Habit. I've just finished the call when I pick up the mail and carry it to the kitchen. I badly need water. My mouth has a dry, metallic taste, like old blood. As I'm drinking, I sort through the circulars, charity pleas, local business mailings. I pause on something that doesn't belong. A manila envelope with my name and address printed on the outside, and a postmark from Willow Creek, Oregon. That's my last remailing service, so whatever's inside has followed a long, broken trail to reach me. I don't touch it. I open a drawer and take out a pair of blue nitrile gloves. I slip them on before I carefully, neatly slit open the top of the envelope and pull out the other one, business size, that sits within it. I recognize the return address in a flash and drop that envelope unopened to the counter. It isn't a conscious decision, no more than if I'd realized I was holding a live cockroach. The letter is from El Dorado, the prison where Mel is held waiting for his execution day. It's been a long wait, and the lawyers tell me it'll be at least 10 years before his appeals are exhausted. And Kansas hasn't carried out an execution for more than 20 years. So who knows when his sentence will finally be imposed? Until it is, he sits and thinks. He thinks a lot about me. And he writes letters. There's a pattern to them that I've figured out, and that is why I don't immediately touch this one. I stare at the envelope for a long time, and it catches me by surprise when I hear the front door open and the alarm starts beeping. Lanny's fast fingers cancel and reset. I don't move from where I am, as if the envelope might attack if I don't stare it down. Lanny puts the keys in the potted plant and walks past me to open the fridge and pull out a bottled water, which she cracks and gulps thirstily before saying, "So let me guess, brain-dead Connor forgot to turn on the alarm? Again? Did you shoot him?"
I don't answer. I don't move. From the corner of my eye, I'm aware she's staring at me, and that her body language shifts as she realizes what's going on. Before I can guess what she's planning, my daughter grabs the envelope off the counter. No, I turn on her, but it's too late. She's already sliding a black painted fingernail under the flap and ripping it open, revealing pale paper inside. I reach out to snatch it away. She steps back, agile and angry.
Does he write to me, too? To Connor? She asks me. Do you get these a lot? You said he never wrote.
I hear the betrayal in her voice, and I hate it.
Lanny, give me the letter, please.
I try to sound authoritative and calm, but inside I am drowning in dread. She focuses on my hands, sweating inside the blue gloves.
Jesus, Mom, he's already in jail. You don't have to preserve any damn evidence.
Please. She drops the torn envelope and unfolds the paper.
Please don't, I whisper. Defeated. Sick.
Mel has a schedule. He'll send two letters that are perfectly, wonderfully the old Mel I married. Kind, sweet, funny, thoughtful, concerned. They will show exactly the man he pretended to be, down to the last loving declaration. He doesn't protest his innocence, because he knows he can't do that. The evidence was never in doubt. But he can, and does, write about his feelings for me and the children, his love and care and concern. 2 times out of 3. But this is the third letter. I see the exact moment when all her illusions are ripped away, when she spots the monster in those carefully inked words. I see her hands tremble, like the needle of a seismograph signaling an earthquake. I see the numb, scared look in her eyes, and I can't bear it. I take the paper from her suddenly unresisting hand, fold it shut, and drop it on the counter. Then I put my arms around her. She's stiff for a moment, and then she melts against me, face hot against mine, fine little shakes convulsing her body like wild current. Shh, I tell her, and stroke her black hair as if she's 6 years old, a child scared of the dark. Shh, baby, it's okay. She shakes her head, pulls away, and walks to her room. She closes the door. I look at the folded paper and feel a surge of hate so strong that it nearly tears me apart. How dare you, I think to the man who's written those words, who's done that to my child. How dare you, you fucking bastard. I don't read what Melvin Royal has written to me. I know what it says, because I've read it before. This is the letter where the mask comes off, and he talks about how I've disappointed him, taken his children away and poisoned them against him. He describes what he'll do to me if he ever has a chance. He's inventive, descriptive, repellently direct. Then, as if he hasn't threatened to brutally murder me, he switches gears and asks how the kids are doing, says he loves them. And of course he does, because in his mind, they're just reflections of himself, not real people in their own right. If he meets them now, recognizes they're not the little plastic dolls he loved before, they'll become other, potential victims, like me. I put the letter back in the envelope, pick up a pencil, mark the date on it, and put the envelope back in the larger remailing service packaging. I feel better once that's done, as if I've disposed of a bomb. Tomorrow I'll send the entire package back, marked "No such address," and the remailing service will have pre-existing instructions to FedEx it to the Kansas Bureau of Investigation agent in charge of Melvin's case. So far, the KBI hasn't been able to figure out how he gets those letters past the prison's normal screening process. I still hold out hope. Lanny is wrong about why I put on the gloves. It isn't to preserve evidence. I wear them for the same reason doctors do. To prevent infection. Melvin Royal is a contagious, fatal disease. The rest of the day is deceptively quiet. Connor says nothing about the incident in his bedroom. Lanny says nothing, period. The two of them boot up a video game, and while they're at it, my time is my own. I make dinner,
like a normal mother. We eat in silence. The next day, Lanny stays locked in her room, since she's banned from the classroom. I decide not to interfere. I can hear her binge-watching a TV show. Connor's off to school. It itches at me to have him go alone to the bus stop, and I watch from the window until he climbs on board. It would irritate him beyond measure if I actually walked him there and waited. When he returns that afternoon on the bus, I step out to greet him but cover it by pretending to poke around in the small flower garden at the front of the house, as if his arrival is completely incidental. He gets off the bus, heavily burdened by his backpack, and two other boys pile off after. The three of them talk, and for a second I worry about bullies, but they seem friendly. The strangers are both blonde, one about Connor's age and one a year or two older. The older one is alarmingly tall and broad, but he gives Connor a friendly wave and grin, and I watch the two of them jog off to take the trail to the left. They certainly don't belong to the Johansons, who are an older couple with grown kids who visited them exactly once since I've been here. No, they must be Officer Graham's kids. Graham is a uniformed member of the Norton Police Force. Unlike me, Graham's family is old Tennessee. From what I've heard, he's the last of several generations of solid country people who had property here at the lake, well before it ever turned into the playground of the wealthy. I still need to drop by, introduce myself, assess the man, and try to start a quiet alliance. I might need law enforcement on my side at some point. I've tried a couple of times but gotten no answer at the door. That's understandable. Cops work odd hours. "Hey, kid, how was school?" I ask Connor as he trudges past me. I pat the soil I disturbed more firmly back around a spray of blooms. "Fine," he says without enthusiasm. "I've got a paper due tomorrow." "On what?" He hitches his backpack into a more comfortable position. "Biology. It's okay, I've got it. Do you want me to read it when you're done?" "I'm okay." He goes inside and I stand up to rub the dirt from my palms. I worry about him, of course. Worry about the scare I gave him and myself yesterday. Worry about whether or not he needs more counseling. He's turned into such a quiet, introverted kid, and it scares me as much as Lanny's outbursts. I don't know what he's thinking most of the time, and every once in a while I see a look, a tilt of his head, that reminds me so strongly of his father that I go cold inside, waiting to see that monster look out of his eyes, but I've never seen it. I don't believe that evil is inherited. I can't. I make a pizza for dinner, and we've all eaten and are watching a movie together when the doorbell rings, followed by a loud, brisk knock. It makes my throat seize up, and I come off the couch in one convulsive leap. Lanny starts to get up, and I urgently motion her back, silently gesturing for her and Connor to go down the hall. They look at each other. The knock bangs again, louder. It sounds impatient. I think about the gun in its safe under the couch, but then I slowly ease the curtain back and peek outside. Police. There is a uniformed officer on our front porch, and the old feeling of anxiety threatens to drown me for a moment. I'm Gina Royal again. I'm back on our old Wichita street, my hands cuffed behind my back, looking at the handiwork of my husband, listening to myself scream. "Stop," I tell myself. Then let the word ring through my body like Javi's ceasefire command at the gun range. I disarm the alarm and open the door, not allowing myself to think about what could happen next. A big, pale policeman is standing there, sharply dressed and creased and polished. He's a foot taller than I am and broad in the shoulders, and he has that wary, unreadable look I'm so familiar with, comes standard issue with badges. I smile at him despite the wail of panic going on inside me. "Officer, how can I help you?"
"Hi. Ms. Proctor, right? Sorry to drop in like this. My son told me your boy lost this on the bus today. I figured I'd return it."
He hands over a small silver flip phone. Connor's. I recognize it instantly. I color-code the kids' phones so they don't mix them up, and I can tell at a glance which is which.
I feel a flash of anger at my son for being careless, and then one of real fear. Losing a phone means losing our tight control of information, though the only numbers he has programmed in are to his friends here, to me, and to Lanny. Still, it's a breach in our wall, a lapse of attention. I don't say anything in a timely fashion, not even thank you, and Officer Graham shifts a little. He has a strong boned face, clear brown eyes, and an awkward little smile.
I've been meaning to stop over and say hello, but look if this is a bad time.
No, no, of course not. I'm sorry. I mean thank you for returning this. Lanny has reached forward and paused the movie by now, and I step aside to let him come in. As he does, I shut the door and, by sheer reflex, rearm the system. Can I offer you some refreshment? It's Officer Graham, right?
Lance O'Graham, yes, ma'am. Lance, if we're not being fancy.
He has a solid, old-school Tennessee accent, the kind that comes from never venturing far from your doorstep.
If you've got some iced tea, that'd go down nice.
Of course. Sweet tea?
Is there any other kind?
He has his hat off immediately and self-consciously rubs his head, disordering his hair.
Sounds wonderful. I've had a long, thirsty day.
I'm not used to liking someone instinctively, and he seems to be working hard to charm me. It puts me on my guard. He's going out of his way to be polite, respectful, and he has a way of carrying himself that minimizes his broad frame and muscles. Probably damn good at his job. There's a certain timbre in his voice. He can probably talk down an angry suspect without laying a finger on anyone. I don't trust snake charmers, but I like the easy smile he gives my kids. That goes a long way. It occurs to me then that I should be damn grateful that it's a cop who's brought back this phone. It's password protected, of course, but in the wrong hands, knowledgeable hands, it could have done damage. Thanks so much for returning Connor's phone, I say as I pour Officer Graham iced tea from a pitcher in the fridge. I swear he's never lost it before. I'm glad your son found it and knew who it belonged to. I'm sorry, Mom, my son says from the couch. He sounds subdued and anxious. I didn't mean to lose it. I didn't know it was gone. Most tweens, I think, would miss their phone if parted from it for 30 seconds, but my kids are forced to live in an alien world, one where they can't use their phones for much beyond the basics. No such thing as smartphones to them. Of the two of the kids, I'd have said Connor was more into the tech. He had buddies, geeky buddies, who texted him at least. Lanny was less social. It's okay, I tell him, and mean it, because, God, I'd busted on my poor son enough for a lifetime this week. Yes, he'd forgotten to set the alarm. Yes, he'd lost his phone. But that was normal life. I needed to ease up and stop acting like every single lapse was lethal. It was stressing me and all of us out. Officer Graham perches on one of the bar stools at the counter to sip his tea. He looks comfortable enough and gives me a friendly grin as he raises eyebrows in appreciation.
Good tea, ma'am, he says. Hot day out in the squad car. I can tell you this goes down well.
Any time, and please call me Gwen. We're neighbors, right? And your sons are Connor's friends? I glance at Connor as I say it, but his expression is closed. He is turning his phone over and over in his hands. I think with a stab of guilt that he is probably worried what kind of rant I'll tear off on once the company is gone. It comes to me with ruthless clarity that I've been far too militant with my kids. We've finally settled in a nice place, surrounded by peace. We don't have to act like hunted animals now. There are 8 broken trails between the address the troll discovered online and us. 8. It's time to stand down from red alert before I damage my kids irreparably. Lance Graham is looking around the place now with a curious expression.
You sure done a great job with this house, he says. I was told it got trashed, right? After the foreclosure?
God, it was a total mess, Lanny says, which startles me. She usually isn't one to voluntarily jump into a conversation with a stranger, especially a uniformed one. They destroyed everything they could. You should have seen the bathrooms. Utterly gross. We had to wear white plastic suits and face masks to even go in there. I puked for days.
Must have been kids partying here, then, Graham says. Squatters would have had a little more care for the place unless they were high all the time. Speaking of that, I should tell you that even out here we have our own drug problems. Still some meth cooking going on up in the hills, but mainly the big business is heroin these days, and oxy. So you keep an eye out. Never know who's using or pushing.
He pauses in the act of raising his glass to his lips.
You didn't find any drugs in here when you were clearing up?
Whatever we found, we tossed, I tell him, which is entirely true. I didn't open any boxes or bags. Everything went out that wasn't nailed down, and half of that we pried up and replaced. I doubt there's anything hidden around here now.
Good, he says. Good. Well, that's most of my job around here in Norton. Drugs and drug-related robberies, some drunk driving. Not a lot of violent crimes, thankfully. You came to a good place, Miss Proctor... Gwen.
Except for the heroin epidemic, I think, but don't say. Well, it's always nice to meet neighbors. Strong ties make the community better, right?
Right.
He drains his tea, stands, and pulls a card from his pocket, which he lays down on the counter and taps with two fingers, as if nailing it in place.
My numbers are on there. Work and sell. You have any trouble? Any of you. Don't be afraid to call. Okay?
We will, Lanny says before I can, and I see that she's studying Officer Graham with a shine in her eyes. I resist the urge to sigh. She's 14. Crushes are inevitable, and he looks like the poster child for what workouts can do.
Thanks, officer.
Sure thing, miss.
Atlanta, she tells him, and stands up to offer her hand. He gravely shakes it. She never calls herself Atlanta, I think, and nearly choke on my sweet tea.
Pleased to meet you.
Graham turns and shakes Connor's hand, too.
And you're Connor, of course. I'll tell my boys you said hi.
Okay. Connor, by contrast to his sister, is quiet, watchful, reserved, still holding onto his phone. Graham puts his hat back on and shakes my hand last of all. Then I walk him to the door. He turns as if he's forgotten something while I'm disarming the alarm to let him out.
I heard you go to the range, Gwen. You keep your guns here?
Mostly, I say. Don't worry, they're all in gun safes.
And believe me, we know gun safety, Lanny says, rolling her eyes.
I'll bet you're both good shots, he says.
I don't like the quick brother-sister look Connor and Lanny exchange. The fact that I've not allowed them to touch my guns or to learn to shoot is a constant bone of contention between us. It's bad enough that I run panic drills in the middle of the night. I don't want to add loaded weapons to the mix.
I'm there evenings on Thursdays and Saturdays. I'm teaching my boys.
It isn't quite an invitation, but I nod and thank him, and he's on his way in another few seconds. He stops in the open door again and looks at me.
Can I ask you something, Miss Proctor?
Sure, I say. I step out because I sense he wants it private.
Rumors say this house had a safe room, he says. That true?
Yes.
You, been in there?
We got a locksmith out to open it up. There wasn't anything inside it, just some water bottles.
Huh. I'd always thought someone was stashing something in there, if it even existed. Well,
he points back to where he left his card on the counter.
You call me if you need anything.
He leaves without more questions. Something tight and animal hot eases up in me as I lock the door again, enter the code, and walk back toward the couch. Having a strange man in my house makes me itch all over. It reminds me of evenings spent on the couch with my kids, with Mel, with the thing that wore Mel as a disguise. I'd never seen through it. Oh, he could be cold and uninterested and cross, but any human in the world has those flaws. What Mel really was, that was different. Or was it?